welcome to all our listeners and friends around the world. It's great to have you with us today. I hope you're doing well. This is Red Ice Radio, Fire and Ice, straight from the creation myths of the Norse. We are headquartered out of Jutland, the heart of Scandinavia, and my name is Henrik. This is a radio show that highlights beautiful traditions from around the world. This program has, since its inception, gone all over the world. Since 2006, when we started the radio show, and 2001, the website, we've been speaking about every conceivable culture, heritage, tradition, to only now, finally, return back home in the last 6 months or so, and put focus on our own heritage and our tradition, and to do so in a way that it hopefully will inspire you to come with us in this process, or to look closer at your own heritage. RedIceCreations.com is a website where you can find a lot more programs on geopolitics, conspiracy, cover-ups, media, propaganda, history, culture, religion, health, spirituality, and much more. We also feature news, videos, analysis, and more. Dan Rayner is our guest today. He is a 20-year-old politics and philosophy student at the University of Sheffield, England. Dan found Åsatru gradually at the age of 16. At the age of 19, he founded the Nationalist Åsatru News and Nationalist Åsatru Limited, an England-based news and nationalistic Åsatru promotion effort, seeking to promote Åsatru in its purest and most eternal, elegant, and inspirational form, to simultaneously spiritually inspire and politically inspire our elegant, ethereal, and extraordinary Nordic and Germanic folk to stand up and speak for their existences. We will speak more today about Åsatru in a modern context and how it relates to the current political system. And welcome to Red Ice Radio, Dan. Thank you for coming on with us. It's great to talk with you. Hope everything is good over in England today.
Yeah, thank you, too, Henrik, and everything's fine here.
Excellent. Now, you're a young man, and it's great to see young people getting into the kind of topics that we're going to talk more about today and address. It's very, very important. Maybe you can just tell us first how you got attracted to these kinds of topics, and specifically then Åsatru, which we have focused on quite a bit in some of our recent program here, Dan. But what was your path like? Why were you attracted to this?
Well, on an ideological level, I've never not been awakened. I've always been awakened. I grew up working on farms with my parents, and I've always been in tune with nature from that perspective. And thus, on an ideological level, you know, I was never left-wing. I was never, you know, in denial of nature, and thus Åsatru came very, very naturally about 3 years ago, whilst I was still doing my AS levels, which is, you know, the late period of school in the UK schooling system, and I just flowed straight from Åsatru. I was previously, you know, a Dawkinite kind of evolutionary, you know, centric type of a scientific atheist, and I went straight into Åsatru when I started researching who I was as a person. So it was really a search for identity in this era of a lack of identity, of multiracial nothingness. And Åsatru came, first of all, generically as, you know, a search of my ancestors and so on, and then it developed, from my perspective, into being an actual spiritual part of one's life that one should, you know, pursue.
Oh, definitely. Now, tell us a bit more about England and the idea that you never went left as well. I mean, I'd consider England to be almost on par with Sweden in that regard, in terms of the Fabian background and everything else. The most British kids that are raised in the schooling system are kind of inducted into the left, or maybe that's not true.
It is true. It's 100% true. One of the things that actually awoken me at a very early level, from my level of being, you know, just generically, you know, patriotic and so on, into being overtly patriotic and realizing there was something wrong with my civilization, was the fact that I realized my teachers were lying to me in history, for example. So from an early level, from, you know, very, very early, I'm talking about preschool clubs even, you have indoctrination attempts, you know, if it's just in children's books, this is well documented, there's, you know, countless articles on various websites of children's books, you know, multiracial groups of homosexuality promoted as the norm, for example, and, you know, through citizenship lessons at, you know, primary school, and then secondary school, it is absolutely undeniable that there is a clear and systemic indoctrination attempt occurring throughout the British education system.
Yeah, exactly. How are they treating the history of the British Empire and colonialism these days? I would figure that that would be an ace up their sleeve that they can use against young British people these days.
Yeah, it's used to a small extent, but primarily they focus on the contemporary history of a nation, I mean the really modern history. So when they do discuss the British Empire, it won't be, you know, 17th, 18th century. It will be, you know, the conflicts in Kenya between the Mau Mau rebels and so on, and the wars in Malaysia, for example. But that's not until you get into a later stage. So that's A-level history that they'll actually start teaching that. At the lower primary school level, they'll, you know, they'll demonize, you know, Germany's history. They'll demonize, briefly, they'll cover slavery. And in the, you know, Industrial Revolution context, they'll put that in there on the side. You know, not mentioning the reality of slavery on a global level, which is Semitic-dominated and Arab-dominated, particularly in ancient history. And they briefly, you know, go on to the negative aspects of empire, but it's very much a later stage indoctrination.
So tell us a little bit about your relation to Asatru as being part of your heritage. Obviously, we have a lot of raids from Scandinavia over to the British Isles under a longer period there. So do you feel a deep a genetic connection to Asatru?
Yes, of course. Asatru is, of course, a spirituality which evolved alongside our Northern Germanic ancestors over tens of thousands of years. Therefore, you cannot say that you don't have an Asatru connection if you are of Northern European genetic descent. Thus, as an English person, you know, Anglo-Saxon and Viking and Danish blood, you know, it's undeniable not just that I have a connection to Asatru, that each and every last single English person has a connection to Asatru. The Viking raids brought a fantastic resistance against Christianity, which forged an extreme warrior-centric version of Asatru, which was fantastic in relation to English forming English culture and in relation to forging a spirit within the people themselves. The genetic, you know, admixture of Norwegians come straight to from Norway to England, down even far as south to the Shires, and straight across from Denmark, straight across from Germany in the later migration periods, is probably the single greatest genetic contribution the British Isles has ever had. And of course, you know, some would say that the Vikings were just the later phase of a pre-existing Germanic population that had been coming back and forth for centuries. And Asatru is, of course, a religion that is primarily a ethnic religion, undeniably an ethnic religion. But it's tied up in the blood and the DNA of our folk. And thus, my connection to Asatru is, of course, a ancestral spiritual connection, which is obviously simultaneously genetic.
Let's kind of get into a little bit more in terms of when you, what kind of literature you stumbled upon. Was it just generic searching and you just happened to come across it, or were you aware of it from an early age? Maybe, I mean, to a certain extent, I've seen the Viking, you know, kind of the reenactment stuff and things like that. To a certain degree, in some parts of England, it seems to be greater there than it is in some part of Scandinavia, even, which is very interesting. But I mean, look at the, you know, the Faroe Islands and the Shetlands and stuff like that. They have, you know, lots of reenactments there. So were you exposed to it at an early age, Dan?
Yes, obviously. In secondary school, we studied Beowulf, of course. So we actually read that from start to finish and analyzed it and so on. And I remember at my primary school, we used to have, you know, talks and so on the Vikings. And in my secondary school, we did a reenactment of the battle between King Alfred the Great and some Vikings, which is my secondary school in a town called Shaftesbury, which is a hilltop town. And we very much covered the history of that. And, of course, there is annually the Jorvik Viking Festival in Yorkshire, which was where the first Nationalist Statue meeting took place alongside. So, yes, there is a massive reenactment. It's not, I would stray away from saying it's just reenactment or it's just history. There is a deep cultural connection with all things Viking, all things Scandinavian, all things Germanic as such. It's, you know, in everything. It's from the, you know, our words. You can see it throughout the days of the week, as you can in all Germanic calendar systems. You can see it in the place names of our villages, towns, and cities. Places near me, for example, you've got Grimsby over on the Hull, which is named after a Viking called Grimm. And you have this culture which is Scandinavian and Germanic. That is what English culture is. yes, there's a small, tiny amount of Celtic influence. The majority of English culture is staunchly Germanic, and the people, although our people have seemed to have forgotten where our blood comes from and where what our culture is and where our culture came from and what it means to be English, it's there, almost subliminally. It's there in everything our people do in relation to our ancestral customs. There are so many local folkloric type customs and tales that, you know, Scandinavian mythology, lore, customs, they are everywhere in England. You've just got to look for them. And you've just got to look in the customs and areas that aren't urban areas, that haven't been destroyed by Marxist, you know, ideological and cultural degeneration over the past 50 or 60 years.
Yeah.
You'll see it consistently. Even throughout the Christian era, the Anglo-Saxons were, they were so pagan they weren't really Christian. Not in relation to the same understanding of Christians that you would have in Southern Europe, for example. So we've been Germanic pagans in culture on every level for thousands and thousands of years, and it's still visible today. You only have to look for it.
Exactly. Even the English language has been actually heavily influenced by a lot of the words still, and I only there's numerous examples, and I don't have all of them in front of me right now, but you know, sky, anger, you know, like there's so many of these words that actually derive from the Scandinavian heritage, and at a time, I guess, when, you know, the language was formulated. So I think that there should be a recognition of a kind of a, I guess, a pan-national identification, because to a certain extent, the division that has occurred between the different countries, the kind of, and I'm not talking about nationalism as being, as a nation related to the people, but I'm talking about nationalism at a later formation of the countries that we have today, has been kind of a divisionary, something that stood in the way of a kind of recognizing the brotherhood with some of our other people around in Northern Europe. What would you say to that?
I would agree with you wholeheartedly. You know, nationalism only has a valid definition along ethnic lines. There is no other nationalism other than ethnic nationalism, because otherwise the definition of a nation is merely a flawed nature, because you're literally talking about, quote unquote, you know, borders or geographic area of land.
Yeah.
That is completely meaningless almost, because, for example, if we were to travel abroad, you know, as we did to America or in, you know, future millennia to different solar systems, people are going to regard themselves in regards to their genetic ancestry, not in relation to a nation. So nationalism is, of course, undeniably a genetic perspective.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, a little bit later, you brought up the future. I definitely want to focus a little bit more on this later, Dan, in terms of where you see things going and kind of raise some of the positive points that we do see there. But maybe we could just kind of dive in a little bit more in depth into also through first. I want to hear a little bit more from you in terms of how you see this as being an advantage, both use it as a spiritual component in our lives, but also to try to awaken something that has a political connection, because it's obviously something that's lacking in our lives today. We've kind of really let up our guard, so to speak, in terms of this identification with our culture and heritage. So what is the advantage with adopting a Ásatrú kind of viewpoint, if you will?
Well, the advantages of Ásatrú are endless. They are absolutely endless. I've written dozens and dozens of articles on this very topic. Well, effectively, Ásatrú, at its core, is a spirituality, as I said earlier, it's developed alongside our ancestral experience over tens of thousands of years. It is built by us, it was built for us, and we are incomplete without it. Ásatrú is a fundamental aspect of our spirit, of our folk spirit. We have to return to Ásatrú, because Ásatrú has this benefit that it's not just a spirituality, it's not just a religion. I strictly avoid using the term religion. It is more of a way of life in a true sense. It's an ethic, it's a philosophy, it's a political ideology, it's a folkish group identity politic, it's everything in relation to identity, spirit, belonging, and how an individual identifies themselves in relation to the universe, in relation to their people, in relation to everything. So he has an immense power, strictly because, obviously, on a psychological level, and there are multiple pieces of research that verify this. For example, thinking about your ancestors has a positive effect on your intelligence and so on, your dedication, your sincerity, your approach to life.
Yeah, exactly. I know where you're going with this, definitely, and it's a really good point, and it needs to be emphasized to how yeah. we need to adopt this and bring this into our lives, because it's absolutely part of that awakening process, you know. And same thing, I think, even genetically, I mean, I think literally we can get into that later too, but I think that there's something that literally awakens in your DNA when you begin to recognize these aspects. It's literally activating. I mean, we know some of the stuff about, epigenetics and everything else and how that controls kind of, on-off switches in the genetics or whatnot. But I literally think some of these have been closed because of environment and upbringing. But once we kind of open that door, these things are mm-hmm. enabled and you literally feel the connection in your physical body, you know?
Yes. And to prove this, you merely need to go and be a part of an Asatru ritual. That is a fundamental experience. Everyone who wants to be involved or even wants to consider Asatru needs to partake in an Asatru ritual, because the power, you literally feel it. There's no point denying it once you've felt literally the power. It's not some abstract talk of feeling the power or some kind of Christian evangelical claptrap. It's an actual reality that you feel mm-hmm. and that gives you a certain dedication and a certain strength in your life that makes you into a stronger person. Asatru, because it's an ethnic spirituality, when you are dedicated in relation to being true to the Aesir, you are being dedicated to your folk. And through being dedicated to your folk, you are being dedicated to our oldest ancestors, which is, of course, the Aesir themselves through the god Heimdall. So Asatru is undeniably a religion that will unlock and unleash our people, and it's the necessary solution to all of the problems of this era. People talk about there being one phase or one step solutions to a problem not existing, that nothing can be solved so easily. It's not an easy thing to do, for our people to totally and wholeheartedly readopt Asatru, not even to call it Asatru, but for it to be indistinguishable between their identity of the spirit, of spirituality, and their daily life. Not just their daily life, their political ideology and their spiritual ideology, which is then political and the spiritual, they kind of blend into one singular mode, and you stop having this distinction between politics and religion. They become one and the same. That is the inherent strength of Asatru, because obviously you have that done under the context of it being an ethnic religion.
Well, exactly. I mean, we've been, and this is a very strategic point, I think, from the part of our controllers, but to compartmentalize us, that we have, it's like, no, the spiritual aspect is over here, and then the political and moral issue is over here, mm-hmm. kind of thing. It's all about separation in that regard all the time, not a holistic kind of a central foundation. And actually, that's partially why I think that Islam has been so successful, because they have an attitude like this. That's why they're conquering so much at this point, because it's not only a religious movement, it's actually a political movement. And if we, in Europe, I think, don't, not that we need to adopt a similar thing as those, we already have one that already goes mm-hmm. way back and more ancient than they, what they have in that regard. But if we don't adopt that, there is a real and true risk that we're going to be devoured by that movement, by that force,
Yeah, not necessarily the force of Islam, but the generic force of non-white immigrants, whatever spirituality they have, being poured into our nation to the extent where we're then a minority, and then once that's happened, we're absolutely powerless. It's the same power of a political and simultaneously a racial ideology as you see in Judaism. Now, if you think of the organizational strength of Jews, of Jewish supremacists in attacking our civilization, if we can muster a superior level of both political and spiritual strength and willpower in order to counter that on numerical levels, it would be like having, however many Asatru folk we get or we awaken amongst our population, it would be like having a weapon or an ideological force able to defeat Jewish supremacism, to the power of 10.
Dan, while we're on this topic, then tell us a little bit more about. You know, we've spoken with Dr. Kevin MacDonald about this on the program before, and his viewpoint from his book Culture of Critique, and mm-hmm. and what he calls, you know, Jewish, you know, tribalism, or this kind of identification with the in-group and all that stuff. But from your point of view, why do you think that we've been so much under attack that we have been now in the last, 100 plus years or so, and how come they've been so successful? I know this is a huge question in that regard, but what do you think is the background to all of this and this kind of conflict we're seeing in the world today and the attack on the Europeans, you know?
Well, the conflict at its fundamental level is a racial conflict. Races will always seek to dominate or attack or destroy other races, just as any other species within the animal kingdom will do. It's simple nature. Thus, Jewish supremacists attacking our culture and our people is literally like one species trying to wipe out another species or trying to claim territorial ground. The reason why we've been ineffective at this, and if you compare, we've not been absolutely ineffective. Jews have been expelled from European nations, I think, 107 times. So we have been periodically able to rise up against and overcome this Jewish supremacist influence that has tried to systematically destroy European, you know, European folk from the surface of the planet for the last 2,000 years. We have, despite 2,000 years of this effectively an on and off state of war, we have survived. The reason why we have not absolutely triumphed over Jewish supremacism is simply because our people are incomplete. We are missing something, a primary motivational drive, which is both spiritual, racial, ethical, and philosophical. That is Asatru. That is the tied link to our ancestors through our folklore, through our very perspectives of life that are inherent to our people. The way the spirituality of Europeans feels from our perspective, the way we express ourselves, we can see that our European spirituality, it's almost got two faces. It's got the recent Christian conversion to it, which is, you know, an overlay as such. It's not complete. It's, you know, it's an absolute, it's just a veneer of nothingness that's holding our people back. If you look at the fundamentals of Christianity, the Pope said this recently, and in fact you reported this article on your website, that communism, quote-unquote, stole some of the ideals of Christianity. That's a very revealing quote.
Oh, yeah.
Because what it tells you is systematically Christianity is an egalitarian, anti-racial, universalistic
yes.
philosophy.
Yeah.
It works, Christianity effectively works as a disease. It came into our folks' lives through absolute force, not by any merit or not by any positive influence it had, but through sheer force and for a will to dominance by the Roman legions, by, you know, Constantine, who wanted to adopt Christianity for the sake of unifying or standardization of Europe, which of course is a similar ideology we see today with the attempted standardization of a later phase, once they've already got the Christianity, the universal spiritual and philosophical and ethical and political universalization done, then they just move on to the next phase, which required that first phase of corruption, which is the racial destruction of Europe. Now the Christianity's run its course, as a, you know, way you can describe it. So the reason why we have been so susceptible to Jewish supremacist manipulation is because our people have lacked this warlike but simultaneously beautiful, elegant, and ethereal and extraordinary spirituality of, you know, resilience, of honor, of, you know, folkish bound loyalty and strength. It is because of the absence of this self-evidently fantastic Asatru ideology. We use the word Asatru, but the Asatru is just, you know, being true to the Aesir or faith in the Aesir. That's an understatement. It's not just about faith or being true to the Aesir, our oldest ancestors. It's about being true to all our folk and, of course, most importantly, our folk to be, our future generations. It is because of the lack of this, subsequently and self-evidently, that we have been so weak.
Yeah, I find it interesting there, too, about the charity and the egalitarian. I think I'm actually working on an episode right now, video or TV episode, on the Fabian Socialist Society to actually try to kind of show that some of the relationships here. And you're absolutely right. One of the characters or one of the guys here that comes to mind is a Catholic priest. And he was born in like 1797 or something like that. But Antonio Rosmini Serbati, even if I pronounced it correct, I'm not sure, but he founded the Rosminians, they were called, and they were kind of this first, you know, charitable group and all that. And so a lot of the ideas from that, you know, ideology of egalitarianism, as we obviously know, turning the other cheek and all that, that mentality is something that has been very beneficial, again, in the part of how you can take over and conquer a people, you know. So this is something that's been long standing in Europe, and I think in England, though, I mean, that has been something. I guess you feel that you're fighting a little bit uphill in that regard, because a lot of, you know, British and English, you know, patriotism and focus on British heritage and all that, in terms of what I've been able to see anyway, is very, very tied to Christianity. It's a Christian, you know, Anglo-Saxon heritage. That's what we have. You know, even with some of the good stuff that's coming out through the anti-EU sentiments with, you know, UKIP and BNP and all that stuff, kind of still carries that with it. So do you feel that is that something that's working against you, or do you feel that this is something that's good in the short term, but then in the long term we can focus on trying to bridge that out? Because I see that there's a tendency here to kind of break up all the movements maybe too soon, that there's a common interest to a certain degree with some people, whether they happen to be Christians or Ásatrú or something else, right? But it's important to kind of focus on the points where we have agreements, as opposed to out of the gates focus on the disagreements and then breaking up. How do you view this, Dan?
I'm glad you brought that point out, because it's absolutely true. You said how it's self-defeating, the Christian, you know, egalitarian influence being simultaneously within national groups, nationalist groups, of course. It's absolutely true. When you look at these nationalistic groups, there's something about them that they always rise and then fall. They have a period of success and then they fail. You cannot reconcile Christianity with any ethnic nationalism. It's a universalistic creed. Their ideology of Christianity, it literally wages internal war against their nationalism. You'll even see, for example, obviously the BNP, everyone in England knows this. Everyone who's in the nationalist scene knows this fact. The Christianity within the BNP, for example, is the primary force that resulted in them welcoming non-European members. Of course, there was a hilarious YouTube video put out by the British National Party where their reverend welcomed a non-white reverend into the party saying, "Hallelujah." And you see this contradiction between Christianity and ethnic nationalism. And you talk about these groups and whether it'd be better to work with them. You know, their numerical size, they're tiny. The percentage of the vote they get is less than 1% of the vote. They're effectively negligible. You know, the monster raving loony party gets more votes in certain areas. And, you know, the Green Party, for example, gets more votes than any nationalist parties combined. UKIP, although you bring up UKIP, UKIP, although being, you know, culturally Christian, on the surface level, they don't actually push it. They do not push Christianity. Christianity right. is not a focus point of UKIP mm-hmm. at all. And if you've ever been to UKIP meetings or anything at a local level, they're not Christians at all. You talk to them on a personal level, they'll talk about the Church of England, and they hate it because it's filled with, you know, Marxists and queers and so on, and they hate their own church.
Right.
So that is there, indicative of the fact that even if they are quote-unquote cultural Christians, they, you know, they admit, and they know, that Christianity, in its manifestations, in all of its current manifestations, is contradictory to the ideology and political nationalism that they themselves push. And I look at Christian people who are nationalist or even racialist, and I view them in the same way that a Christian nationalist would view a liberal. They are, or a not necessarily liberal, or how a racial nationalist would view a non-racial nationalist. They are less awakened. They are, in a way, not quite there ideologically. Now, we have an absolute duty not to unify the right or to unify the European folk movements that, you know, all seek the preservation of the European folk, but we have, you know, an absolute duty to purify them, not to unify, to purify, to enlighten them, to make them realize that Christianity, through proving it, through articles, through whatever means, through emotive speeches, through any means necessary to prove to these people that Christianity fundamentally cannot and will not and never has for any long period of time, sustained any successful racially nationalist movement or even nation.
Yeah. See if we can talk a little bit more about the European Union and how you see this either being part of a strength or completely just a weakness. I mean, we've talked before a little bit about the origins of the European Union and the idea that it was actually kind of founded on this very much a socialist Christian concept. Now, I know that for a lot of Americans, that's difficult to understand because they've had a tradition of being more, they're kind of more conservative when it comes to their Christianity. But in Europe, that is not so. That's a very different kind of approach to it there. But is there anything within the components of the European Union as a unifying force, meaning infrastructure and everything that's in place there now, that actually is something that is ultimately is good? Because a lot of the anti-European Union parties in Europe that are actually gaining some kind of, you know, a little bit of a momentum right now, I heard other critics point out that, oh, wait a minute, it's bad if they basically try to just pull everybody out of the European Union and kind of break that bond that we have, kind of enable within the infrastructure of it. And I guess their point of view is instead, no, let's use it to our advantage. Let's actually work with the European Union as it exists there. The only thing that has to change, I guess, in that regard is the fundamental ideological stance. Now, whether that's just a pipe dream or not, I'm not here to answer that regard. But what do you think about that, and how do you view the European Union and the anti-European Union movement within Europe right now?
Well, there are two fundamental views on this question. There is the view that we can leave the European Union and restore a nationalistic government through leaving it and becoming independent, or there is the view that we can literally take over the European Union from the inside and then use it ourselves to recorrect all of the problems in Europe using the already pre-existing superstructure of the European Union. I would be very skeptical of the ability to use the European Union itself, to do these changes, because the European Union, the way it's constructed, it didn't have a parliament until the 1970s. You know, it did not have any democratic, you know, legitimacy or accountability until the 1970s, and yet it operated for that entire duration from its formation until that point without even a single vote of consent through direct, you know, or even a delegate or representative democracy. So, and if you can see that even if you take over the parliament, you cannot even stop commission legislation. Even if you had full control of the European Parliament, if the Commission wanted legislation pushed through, and if the European Council was in support as well, they could push it through, even if the European Parliament disagreed. So there is absolutely no electoral way within the European Union that you can take full control of it. Now, if you took control of your heads of government, on the other hand, and took control of the European Parliament, then you control all of the appointments procedures, then you could take control of it. But the massive problem with that is that's going to be a massive delay on the timescale within which we could retake it, which means by that point the percentage of our populations that are still European would be, you know, 5 or 10% smaller, because I'm talking about 10 or 20 years longer it would take to retake the European Union in its entirety. We can reconstruct a European Union or a European military and political alliance if we wanted to at any point in the future. I think it is crucial that we retake our nations first and foremost as quick as possible in order to, you know, prevent the demographic trend that's ongoing. So, effectively, I believe that through countries pulling out of the European Union and going in a nationalistic direction, there will literally be a domino effect of that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that any countries left within the European Union will, you know, the European Union will collapse at some point. It will cease to be. So there have been protests against the European Union in every single member state. It's clear the European Union is losing credibility, and so we don't even have to worry about if the European Union is going to collapse and if we're going to get national sovereignty back or not. It is going to happen if the political will exists in our people, and this is why Atatürk is so necessary on a political level, because it instills that political or spiritual drive and motivation to defend one's folk, to honour one's ancestors through defending one's folk. And once that is reached, once our people are strong enough in themselves to be able to continually and consistently organize and enact strikes or demonstrations or political movements, you know, overtly or covertly, such as UKIP, we will be in a position where the European Union effectively collapses, and we will literally have to rebuild something ourselves if we wanted something like the European Union in the future. I believe that it would be good, and it is pretty much necessary, to have a military alliance between the European nations and, of course, you know, the free trade area, or, you know, free trade area within Northern Europe at least, and then a free trade area in Southern Europe and then one in Eastern Europe. But we need to absolutely get rid of the European Union as an institution, because if you're trying to take it over institutionally, having studied the European Union as a politics student, the amount of legislation that exists and all the clauses here, there and everywhere that are anti-European at their core. Mm-hmm. I wrote an article on my website, The Jewish Origins of the European Union. You say that there's Christian egalitarian element. Yes, defiantly, there is. Defiantly and definitely, there is. But that Christian element is underpinned and informed by, you know, an absolute Jewish founding father, of course. You know, there's Kuddenhove, Kalergi,
yeah,
and all of the heads of the original think tank-like bodies that decided to create the European Union conspiratorially at the same time as the Latin Monetary Union collapsed, of course. It's, you know, it's absolutely Jewish and Christian, you could just therefore say Semitic, to its core, fundamentally, in every way it works, especially in the cultural exchanges between Northern and Southern Europe, the cultural, you call it cultural miscegenation or pollution between different nations that just confuses and rips apart their identity at a core. The Marxist redistribution of wealth from Northern Europe to Southern Europe, from Eastern Europe to Western Europe, which then, of course, gets focused around urban areas filled with non-white immigrants, which then come in once they're in through one European state. They have then free access through the majority of European states. For example, our borders are no longer Calais, our borders are no longer the Arsene Bridge for you over in Sweden. Our borders are the coast of Italy,
yeah,
for example.
That's right, exactly.
And we cannot have any free movement in such a degree in relation to immigration. We cannot have situations where you have such economic centralization or education or political centralization, because it's fundamentally against, you know, the interests of the folk peoples individually. Within the European Union at the moment, there are, of course, multiple subgroups within the European race. Of course, you have Nordics, Germanics, you have Slavics, and Mediterranean peoples. Within, say, the difference between, you know, Norway, Sweden, Denmark, and England, there is almost no genetic difference. If you look at the population comparisons in relation to, say, comparing a European with a non-European, a European even with, you know, a Southern European, the Nordic and Germanic folk are effectively indistinguishable. There is no reason why we cannot have, and in fact we should have, a military, you know, legal, trade and spiritual agreement between our nations in order to, you know, reinforce the fact that nationalism is not just about a nation state. It is about a people's.
Yes.
Asatru informs this to the core. You know, that the fact that we have a spirituality that is based on the folk, we should have our politics that is based around our folk. And necessarily, the people who say they want to keep the European Union would be very, very in favor of this idea, and that's something we could use to convince them to come over to the idea that the European Union needs to collapse in its entirety. And in its, from its ashes must rise a flame, of a purifying flame, that will be the unification of all like-minded European peoples on a military level and on a trade level for a common defense and a common purpose within existence, which is for the protection of European folk. And within that, of course, we can have, you know, cultural exchange like we already do between Denmark and England, between Sweden and Norway. You know, they have that, used to have that ceremony where they'd have a little Viking ship sail from Denmark to England,
yeah,
commemorating the landing of the Anglo-Saxons, or the landing of Danes, and a similar thing with the Norwegian Vikings. We should very much seek cooperation, and this is absolutely necessary, because divided we fall is a classic quote. We need to stick together as a folk, but also respect and honor and appreciate our unique differences and characteristics and brilliant identities as folk people. We can only do this if we simultaneously stay independent as a nation and yet simultaneously understand that our concepts of nations need to be in direct accordance with our concept of race. Nation and race should be one and the same, as with spirituality and politics. Asatru unites all of these into one singular perspective on life.
Let's talk a little bit more about that, because I think this will be a point where a lot of people, they might have disagreements, they might not, you know, understand it, they might be flat out angry at this point listening to what you're saying here. But so I think we need to clarify that. I want to hear a little bit more from your perspective about why this is such an important issue. Because I mean, we had Frank Salter with us a while back. I recommend people who did not listen to that show, or maybe you caught him in passing, but re-listen to that again and hear him speak a little bit about it. He's a scientist out of the Max Planck Institute. He spoke to us about king selection theory and actually that multiculturalism causes a lot of issues and problems, unnecessary created problems, and the way that the majority group, you know, replacement level migration, etc., how this is going to change demographics within 2, 3, 4 generations. But why, explain this to us, why is ethnicity important? And, you know, because some people might not be on this page, they might not fully understand it, because this is an issue we're facing in the West, because we're so indoctrinated that we cannot have this as an interest. We cannot focus on this issue because then we're racists, we're evil, wicked people, right? And the fact is that a lot of other cultures and races and groups around the world still have a very ethnic-based, oriented worldview, and they are perfectly fine having this. They're perfectly okay for them to have, you know, if you want to be a Han Chinese, that's absolutely fine. If you want to be Japanese, or if you want to, encourage your own people and everything, there's not much being said about that. But as soon as this comes to the European question, then we're white supremacists who want to kill everyone else. So can you explain this to our audience a little bit more?
That's a fundamental point. And from that, you don't want to go to defending yourself. You want to go on the offensive. Of course, the best defense is a good offense. So you go straight to asking the question, why is that? Why is it not okay to have a love for one's own people as a European, and why it is simultaneously okay and celebrated in other folk peoples? That is, in fact, is a fantastic opportunity. When someone attacks you or gets annoyed with you in that relation, you can then say, and you can introduce them to the cause behind all this. So you can say, well, it's instilled through the media, obviously, you see, and the education system. So when someone gets angry or pretends to be angry at that point, you know, if you go on to a point regarding ethnicity and the importance of ethnicity, like I just did, obviously, having just mentioned that you go on the offense instead of on the defense, and this is crucial in relation to politics, you can go straight into mentioning and proving, and this is why it's essential that we have websites that write articles and contain this information. You can go on to prove and demonstrate that this is, of course, as a result of Jewish supremacist cultural, ideological, and spiritual manipulation from as early as the formation of Christianity. And you can say, it's not, you know, surprising that you think that, if this is, you know, a theoretical person coming up to you on the street, or a liberal being outraged during a debate. You can hit them on this point and say, why do you think that?
Yeah.
And once you do that, you open up the conversation to a whole new sphere, and you can then not just express the importance of ethnicity, but then say, because of their, and bouncing off their reaction to that, that your reaction to that is only as a result of an absolutely malicious and hypocritical Jewish supremacist indoctrination or simple manipulation of your opinions on that subject, and that in itself shows you not only that our people are under attack, that our defense and that being aware of the importance of ethnicity is a necessity in order to withstand that attack, and that those who are attacking you because of that are literally being slaves to those who would destroy our people, and you need to hit them on the emotive level. You need to, so when someone says that to you, you effectively need to turn it around and you say, or to those who's listening who disagree with me on this, you need to realize in yourself that this is not some ideology of racialism just in itself for the sake of it because someone or I'm a racist. It is because this is the manifestation of what the natural manifestation of loving one's own people. Now, loving one's own people is a necessary political ideology.
Yeah. Otherwise, if you don't have that, what do you have? What do you care about it at all? But see, there's two important points here I want to stick to. The one is the aspect that people are yet to comprehend and understand that they're being attacked. I mean, this is a fundamental point, of course. I want to stress this a little bit more. But before we do that, I want to talk about what kind of type of society that is created when it becomes, you know, multicultural. Because there is a disconnection here, of course, between where is this multiculturalism going to take us? One idea is that it's going to lead us into complete cultural, a new kind of a monoculture, which is kind of everything and nothing at the same time. It's just this kind of blah of everything and nothing. And the other idea is that, no, it's going to continue to stay separated. There's going to be segregation within European nations, which is going to, of course, consequently lead to even more and more and more problems and issues and divisions between these groups, as old divide and conquer tactic again, and it might be very difficult. So it's two different strands to that, and I guess one could be that it's the long-term plan of you know, creating this monoculture, but the short-term plan is to create this differential, you know, the obstacle of cultural differences. And, of course, in that scenario, you get a lot of conflict. But my main point is that as it exists today, as I've seen it anyway, within European society, and I'm speaking about Sweden specifically, it's created a kind of hyper-individuality, for the lack of a better term. People become isolated in this. I noticed that when I was down in Belgium, it was a perfect example. I tried to reach out to one gentleman to just ask him about the road to somewhere we were I can't remember where we were going, but we're heading out of the city. We're in Antwerp, I think, and I didn't realize where I was. There were European buildings, but there were so many Muslims in Antwerp. It was really interesting to see that. It's just like, where am I? But anyway, there was a gentleman I tried to flag down, and he did look at me briefly, but he just basically kept on walking. He didn't recognize me, and I was kind of I thought, what's wrong with this guy? And I got to bother him a little bit more, you know? So I really tried to get in there and like, hey, man, come on, just answer me a question. You know, I'm not going to bother you. I'm not dangerous. Come on. Let me just ask you where I can go to head out of the city, you know? And he just head down, just kept on walking. And I realized, wait a minute, he's completely isolated. He doesn't even talk with anybody. He head down, he knows nothing what's going on around him. He doesn't care. He can't. I mean, in some cases, he might not even understand the language that is being spoken around him the majority of the time. So my question, in a long roundabout way, Dan, is what kind of society does the multiculturalism that we see on the rise now in Europe create? And do you think that this isolationism of these small individual atomized pockets that we're seeing, do you think that that's the ultimate goal here?
Well, ultimately, it creates nothing. It is not a creative force. It is, of course, a destructive force under the facade of making something creative. It does not aim to create even a multiculture. Of course, if you look at the ideologies and the ethnic realities of the creation of so-called multicultural states, even implicitly multicultural ones that never adopted the policy but were in effect multicultural, look, for example, at post-apartheid South Africa, you realize that it's not about creating. It's about destroying. In fact, it's about annihilating. That is what we're up against. And if you see this situation where you have individuals who are absolutely catatonic, who are going into, you know, an individualistic and almost a reclusive lifestyle to escape from the destruction of their society, well, that happens naturally. Humans shut down as natural humans. Once they lose their communal relations, they stop acting in that way that you recognize as being human. They become less than that. They become isolated, purely individualistic. You know, it's almost like a self-fulfilling prophecy. They become like the Marxist, you know, view of people, which is people as economic units.
Right.
It's not necessarily the objective, and I would argue that it is not the objective of multiculturalism to create a Marxist individuality. Maybe of the remaining non-Europeans it would do that too, but its objective first and foremost is an attempt, and it will fail, because our people are awakening, has been proven in survey after survey. I think immigration, hostility to immigration in the UK is in between 89 and 94%.
Really?
66% wow. of that wanting serious measures taken against immigration. That's YouGov polls, Channel 4 poll, and a BBC and ITV poll average.
Wow. That's a lot, yeah.
Yeah, it is. It's UK is one of the most...
Exactly, and yet nothing is happening to it. I mean, that's part of the frustration here. It's like, sure, everyone sits around and thinks, but what are they doing about it? What's happening? Nothing. Nothing is happening.
And that's because there's been a systemic infiltration attempt within the UK, within all nationalist efforts. The BNP, for example, taken over by Nick Griffin in 1999, literally directed to fail. Where you have the primary nationalist movement of an entire nation literally being co-opted and designed and pushed towards its own failure. Of course, that immigration, hostility to immigration, is going to result in no political manifestations because the political manifestation which claims to represent it is simultaneously betraying it. We only now see change, and it is colossal. It has been tagged across the international media as a political earthquake, the single most significant electoral victory of any party over 100 years, which of course was UKIP in the EU election, where it beat both the mainstream incumbent opposition and government parties. Not until you actually have some logistical political parties enacting our people's will you actually have a change. And so that individualistic corruption and destruction of our people is only made worse by the fact that there is no political, or, you know, not necessarily no, but vastly insufficient political logistical efforts by our people in relation to trying to retake our nation. And that is why we so fundamentally need some, you know, a large group of folk all over the European world who follow ASATRU, which gives you this unrelenting desire and willpower to serve your folk and to do what is best for your beloved people. It is an ideology driven from love, and that is the solution to this current problem we have with individualism being co-opted or taken to the extreme reclusive endgame of such. You know,
Well, exactly. And I mean, there's no brotherhood anymore. There's no camaraderie, no unification, no common, you know, heritage in that regard, and except but a few ideologues that are, I think, honestly lying to themselves and think that this is not an issue. But it's an awful sacrifice to make for the purposes of severing yourself from your heritage and culture and identity and peoples and everything, just for the sake of trying to fulfill this political pipe dream of a rainbow nation or in a concept of how they think it should be. Of course, this is how the political class have appealed to people to sell it as it's a marketing scheme in that regard. But the reality, just as you say, of this dream is a nightmare. And again, just as planned, just as this is how we are to become easily controlled units in a global state. And I mean, if people, you know, love what the, you know, folks in the New World Order are doing, the global banking industries and everything that we've seen in the last, 20, 30 years now really going up and ramping up. If you're in support of all that, then you should be in full support of what's happening right now, too, with this multicultural lie that they're trying to sell to us. You know, so this is something I think that people need to think about and really understand. What is the purpose of this? Because the other part to this question I wanted to address here before we take a break in a little bit is this concept that people don't understand that they're actually being targeted. They have an idea that, you know, in the way that they've been educated in their lives about, you're nice to everybody, everything is good, you're peaceful, and you might have a really good attitude to all of this stuff that's happening right now. But the fact is that it does not entail and mean that everyone is on your page and think about this in the same way. I mean, we can take some examples. For example, we have, you know, La Raza in the U.S. That's a big, huge issue that they're struggling with, the south of the border now, literally trying to take over the, you know, the territory and the land again, and literally exterminate, you know, the white people in the southwest. In Europe, we have, for example, the Muslim Brotherhood and other kind of smaller and organizations that are tied into this, and these folks are literally talking about conquest, taking over our lands. They see this as the prize. I mean, we actually featured a documentary a while back about an Iraqi guy living in Norway who actually went down to Egypt and tracked some of the Muslim Brotherhood, some of the things that they were doing there, and you know, showing some of the clips on, I think it was Turkish TV, where they're sitting talking about, you know, laughing at the Europeans and their demographics and say, ha, 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 you know, in 4 or 5 generations, we've taken over everything, you know. So what would you say to someone who doesn't understand that there are people, and okay, granted, there might be people say, well, these are extremist groups. This does not mean the general person or immigrant out there that comes into your country or whatever. But my point is trying to be, I still believe that all of these people have an ethnic-based consciousness. This is an idea that more of me and my people like myself is good, less of them is also good. That's what we want, even if this is subconscious or whatnot. I think it's just kind of part of the psyche and the makeup. You want to be around people like your own, right? So how would you address this issue of trying to point out to the reality that this is a conquest that we're witnessing? We are being targeted to a certain extent, and just because you're not seeing this or realizing this doesn't mean it's not happening. How do we awaken people to this concept of the struggle, if you will, that we're facing right now, Dan?
Well, you show them that reality. You show them the videos of the people saying that, and you show them such things over and over again. You have websites like such as yours, and you have videos, and you literally make it so people cannot go through their daily lives without seeing it, either from you showing it or from these immigrants doing it themselves. And you want to show people not in a way that, you know, makes them think that, oh no, it's all over and we're going to be destroyed. You want to say to people, we will and we can triumph, and Europe will be great again, and our people will be free to exist as our own folk with our own lands. And you want to instill in our people an idea and a dream of positivity. Because people do not get motivated by seeing that immigrant birth rates are increasing in number. They don't want to even understand that, because that's a frightening thought for the ordinary liberal person to have their entire worldview shattered to pieces. So you don't want to go from a negative perspective. To awaken up people, you need to simultaneously have a positive message. For example, the message inherent and intrinsic to Asatru. You know, an entire positive spiritual approach to your life and politics, which is simultaneously not, you know, arguably spiritual, but yet highly rational. You want to take something like this and you want to use it to inspire people. And that's the only way we're going to awaken our people, is by simultaneously giving them the confidence and the understanding to tackle these issues, to simultaneously inform. To be honest, everyone knows that immigration is going to make us a minority in our country, you know, within, you know, this or that prediction, because it's been all over mainstream news in several different periods. For example, the BBC's had, you know, a few interviews here and there where they've had people going on television saying, well, London's now only 45% white, or we're going to be a minority by 2050 or something.
Yeah.
We already know about this. Our people know about it on that level. They need to feel it. They need to feel this understanding. They need to gain a love for their folk. And loving our folk on an ethnic and spiritual level is the only natural ideology of nature, and thus the only ideal and only truly or naturally rightfully mainstream or default political ideology for a folk group. And this is what we need to reinstill. This is how we reawaken our folk, not through facts and figures primarily, secondarily, yes, but through emotive awakening of our people so they can love our folk, to learn to love themselves as the extraordinary, elegant, and ethereal Germanic and Nordic folk they are.
Well, exactly. Very important point. I want to wrap up on this with the first segment. We want to talk about your website in a little bit. But basically, have people understand, because this is the reality of it. This is not something that comes from a position of hatred and opposition. That's what our opposition, those who want to enforce this control grid upon the world, those who want to eradicate, you know, European natives and our culture and everything that it stands for, they've been trying to paint us in this light for such a long time, that this is about, you know, we coming from a position of hate or wanting to, you know, kill everyone else or something ridiculous like that. This is just, as you say, it's just a point of love and appreciation, not only for who you are, but your own people, and having a veneration for the fact that this is something that is everyone's, well, I don't want to use the word right because it doesn't really exist in nature. There is no such thing as a right, but this is something that is a prerequisite within nature, that you have this as a self-preservation, you know, kind of modality. Otherwise, if you don't, you're you might as well be lost and gone in it, because everything in nature has a self-perpetuating force within it. It wants to survive. It wants to spread itself. And anything who doesn't want to have that, it quickly disappears in nature. There's nothing like that out there. So it's about showing this, and it's about making people realize that there are tremendous, beautiful things within our heritage, within our culture as it exists. I mean, I've heard politicians in Sweden, people in Sweden and other parts of Europe as well, you know, talking about this nonsense that we're like, oh, we don't really have a real culture. It's not really there. It's kind of a, you know, it's been like a blank slate. We have a classic social democratic or socialist democratic politician in Sweden, Mona Sahlin. I've brought this up many times, but she literally goes in front of these like Turkish youth groups and talk about, oh, all we have is the Midsummer's Pole and meatballs. You know, that's kind of it. That's all we have. And I mean, either these people are so far removed from reality and everything that has to do with history, that I don't know what's going on in there, or they actually are, they literally have a hatred for it so much that they wanted to see the destruction of it. That we could go on and analyze that forever, but the point there anyways, it is about showing that there are some tremendous, beautiful things that is part of our heritage, and it's worth preserving, and people need to realize and wake up to this fact. That's what this is about, I think.
Yes, definitely.
All right, Dan, so let's, before we wrap things up here for the first segment, and give us your website. Tell us just briefly about what some of the things people can find there and what you have in the works and coming up in the plans. You've been working on some videos and stuff like that, so tell us more about that.
Well, just type in Nationalist Asatru. It'll come up the first hit on Google. Nationalist Asatru, Nationalist Asatru News. Effectively, it's a website that I've launched since last year, and it's everything I've just talked about and more. It's effectively an effort to inspire and to inform my people. It's obviously England-centric, but obviously the Asatru in itself is, as we've just been talking about, relevant to every single Northern European, every Nordic and Germanic European on the surface of this planet. But my website is effectively, in my view, it's phase one of a plan I have to provide that political, logistic capability and support to enable a large number of my people to start awakening the rest of our people in order to attempt to or assist with the retaking of England, primarily, first and foremost. Effectively, my website is, you know, a video, an article website. I have an upcoming documentary which I've been filming. It's about a week and a half away from production release, where I expose the effect of ethnic cleansing that's occurred in Pagehall, Sheffield, which is an area that's been in the news several times for, you know, the rumours of it being on the brink of a race war and so on, and an ex-Labour minister even saying that it's, you know, officially an area that's about to explode. Mm-hmm. I'm making a documentary on that subject.
Right.
And I've made a few videos here and there. And obviously, in the next year or so, I have the plans to start a membership organization to promote Asatru itself. My primary objective is Asatru. I need not even have the word nationalist in the title of the website, because Asatru encompasses that naturally.
Right.
And, you know, Asatru, if you want to find things out about Asatru, I have dozens and dozens and dozens of articles, and even poetry on the website.
Right. Yeah, that's what we need.
To inspire people. That is what needs to happen.
Absolutely. You are right. So it's Nationalist Asatru with a U at the end. I say Asatru because that's how we say it in Sweden, so I don't want people to confuse that. We'll have the URL up, of course. But again, nationalistasatrunews.com. That is the website. Check that out. All right, Dan Rayner, stay with us. We'll return with more after the break. Much more I want to ask you about, so we'll be right back. in the next hour as we proceed on the members' website. Dan speaks on the conditions in the UK after mass immigration. He says an ethnic resurgence of identity is taking place in the minds of the native Europeans. He also talks about foreign policy and the political problems instigated by Jewish supremacists. We'll also discuss today's political ideologies that are unnatural and not in line with Åsatru ethics. Later, we talk about health, since Åsatru is about doing everything in accordance with nature. We also talk about the role of technology and clarify that paganism does not mean being a Luddite. Lastly, Dan shares what happened when his university confronted him on his website and their attempts to target him and get him suspended. You can continue to listen at redicemembers.com. With a subscription, you get full access to all our previous programs on similar and many other topics that has inspired, informed, and enlightened us. We have well over 800 programs, hundreds and hundreds of hours. We do spare you from commercial interruptions, and the program is listener-supported, so if you like what we do, sign up for a membership and help keep us ad-free. Thank you. More is coming, by the way, with Jay Widener, Gordon Duff from Veterans Today, and Sonia Barrett. We'll also speak with David Icke again a little bit later. Then next month we have Gordon Kenny and also Gary Biltcliff. But we'll proceed right now with Dan Rayner, redicemembers.com.